right, welcome to another episode of the Doomer Optimism podcast. I'm joined today by the newly illumined James Poulos, who you do a lot of different things. He's a writer and editor and a chronicler of the digital age and the spiritual ramifications of digital technology. I don't know if that's a fair description of your work. So for those totally unfamiliar with you, in the Doomer Optimism world, where should people begin with your work? Where can we find you?
Well, it's great to be on. Thank you for having me. And I'll run down the list. I'm the editor of the American Mind, Claremont Institute. That's AmericanMind.org. I've got a TV show on Blaze TV called Zero Hour. Check that out. Always lurking and posting on X.com at James Polis. And you may, if you're watching this, be interested in a book called Human Forever: The Digital Politics of Spiritual War. That is a Bitcoin exclusive on canonic.xyz. It's a great time to get involved in Bitcoin, not just because number go up, but because this is one of the foundational digital technologies in this world that, if it is dominated by the wrong sorts of people, it will become an instrument of spiritual oppression. But if it is wielded by those who have proper spiritual authority, then it can be used to the good. It can be used to strengthen our way of life. It can be used to strengthen our beleaguered form of government here in America, and it can be used to strengthen our humanity itself. That was the theory of the case for me putting the book on Bitcoin at Canonic, and I invite you to give it a spin.
Okay, I want to talk, ask you about Bitcoin later because I haven't been able to make sense of it yet. Maybe you can help me. But I want to start with your first book, which was about Tocqueville. And when I got the book, I had an im I had in my head what I thought it was going to be, and it ended up being something very different. So the way I read Tocqueville, and maybe you can correct me, is that he's a critic of democracy, but he felt that the victory of democracy was inevitable. I think he says it's providential. And so given that the aristocratic or monarchist opposition to democracy he felt was going to fail, they had to come up with some way to temper all the problems inherent in democracy. And so, among other things, that's what he sets out to do. I mean, he does a lot of things. Everyone should read Tocqueville's book about America. It's like looking in a mirror, a very revealing mirror. So I assumed what your book was going to be was something like there are all sorts of problems with the victory of the digital and of Silicon Valley's ascendance, but its victory is inevitable in a way, and so it has to be tempered. That's what I assumed your book was going to be, but it's different. It turned out to be very different from that. So I'm curious twofold. One, what if you read Tocqueville the same way I do, or how you take Tocqueville? And two, what could you describe what you ended up doing in that book?
Sure. That book, The Art of Being Free, was written in 2015 and 2016. Books that go through the Big Five, New York Publishing, meat grinder, take a while to pop out on the other side. Between the initial agreement to write a Tocqueville book and the hitting of said book on bookshelves, inauguration weekend 2017. So it was up there with, Matt Taibbi's book and all of these Trump and Hillary books. And it was a strange time to release a book Not necessarily a bad time, but definitely the vibe was off along a couple different vectors. Regardless, it was still early enough in the game as far as the technologization of everyday life was concerned. Even in January of 2017, it was still relative to now quite early in the game. So my preoccupations at that time were not really focused around the digital politics of spiritual war, to coin a phrase. There's some stuff in there that touched on it, and the second book that I pitched around or had pitched around for me, when you have your first book published, the thing that you're supposed to do is not celebrate or relax or scrape your psyche back together, but immediately pitch out a book proposal for book number two, because there's no better time to sell a book proposal for book number two than when book number one has hit the shelves, but the sales figures have not yet come in. This is how it works. That book was going to be called Escape Velocity. That book was going to be concerned with humanism and anti-humanism, especially as seen through the controversies around space and space exploration and Mars and all that. That book was universally rejected by every publishing house it was pitched to. Parts of it ended up trickling out as articles spread across the internet. One of which popped up at Foreign Policy. It was called "Elon Musk is not religious enough to go to Mars," to give you a flavor of
Yeah, I read
that
that
problem.
when it came out.
That was now quite a while ago. And so this is a roundabout way of saying that that for me, the focus on Tocqueville concerned his understanding of our predicaments, first through the lens of social theory, not through political theory. My PhD at Georgetown was in political theory. I guess that makes me a trained political theorist, especially at the time, Josh Mitchell and Patrick Deneen were my number one and number two on my dissertation committee. So I got a lot of social theory. It wasn't just kind of, pure hard political philosophy. It was not a Straussian education.
Can you distinguish between social and political theory for us?
I'll just use the example of Tocqueville since he's notionally the topic of this discussion right now. He did not view democracy or analyze democracy as a fundamentally political phenomenon. It was for him fundamentally a social phenomenon, and specifically one the one in which the equality of conditions was prevalent in society, prevalent to a degree that it shaped all of the features of a society in one way or another. And so when he talked about the seemingly providential character of democracy, what he was talking about was not simply the spread of a kind of egalitarian ideology in political life that really got going during the Enlightenment and through the French Revolution, and of course into the American Revolution, but rather a centuries-old process of the gradual but inexorable spread of the equality of social conditions, the social and cultural retreat of aristocratic life and aristocratic social structure, where there are distinct social classes, where each had its role and everyone had his or her place within this kind of great chain of social structure. So for Tocqueville, it was important that this shift away from the aristocratic social structure of European life began, in somewhere in the Middle Ages. He took a very a panoramic view of all of this, and this is just out of the author's introduction, basically said, look, there's no denying at this point that a tremendous sort of force has been moving humanity in Europe and in the parts of the New World away from those aristocratic social structures and toward a new kind of social dispensation. One in which those sharp distinctions between hierarchical classes were melting away and being replaced with a new sort of arrangement in which people increasingly enjoyed the benefits of kind of sloshing around relatively freely in a spontaneous way as relative equals. But there were costs to this, and part of that process involved people psychologically and in their souls feeling and experiencing that they were not simply equals to be, to who could enjoy the satisfactions of greeting one another as equals. But they felt increasingly insignificant and interchangeable as well. Sort of just particles being swept along in this enormous tide of humanity. And their words and their thoughts began to take on that character as well. Sort of mental dust was his phrase for, all the kind of effluvia of what we would call the discourse today, just kind of being blown hither and yon and here today and gone tomorrow.
Have you read Ivan Illich's Gender?
I have not read that Illich in particular, no.
Well, it's interesting that he describes a similar process, but rather than social classes like aristocrats and peasants, but the disappearance of man and woman as sort of separate parallel worlds,
Right.
and then we become humans. And he think he traces this process back centuries also, through changes in marriage contracts and things. But anyway,
Right. So
sorry
yeah,
to interrupt your flow, but it's an interesting process by where women and men really had distinct ways of being. I mean, he notes, in some places where men and women would both work in the fields together, they would use different shaped tools and sing different songs, and anyway, different ways of being and different forms of life that became sort of just flattened out into a general experience of being a human, as
yes, an
opposed to being a robot.
undifferentiated, predicateless persons, as Mitchell liked to, and I think still does refer to them, and all con you know that's all consonant with Tocqueville's analysis. So he wasn't coming at democracy first and foremost as a political phenomenon, but a social one. That said, for Tocqueville, mores, these kinds of habits of the heart, as Robert Bellah would later call them, ultimately arose from religion. And so at a time when so much seemed to be in flux and rushing toward an unclear future away from all that once was, he said that religion is really the only fixed point remaining in the human heart in democratic ages. And that religion strengthened people where they were most inclined to be weak in democratic ages. So exactly at the point where, as one of these insignificant and interchangeable units, human units in an undifferentiated mass, those feelings of isolation, of atomization, of individualism in the bad sense, in the sort of depressing sense, I'm just one person, what can one person do? Having to resort to, what they think, what they say, what they do, this kind of undifferentiated they that becomes the measure of thoughts and actions and choices. The constant pressure to scramble after the goods of this world, which always seem to be slipping through your fingers, and the short space of 70 years is not enough for to satisfy the longings of man. All these kinds of psychological effects of the equality of conditions. leave people in a kind of spiritual oscillation, an exhausting back and forth, kind of a bipolar experience between frenzy, outward facing franticness, and inward facing brooding or despair, melancholy. And for Tocqueville, it was crucial that people, in Europe, in particular, trying to understand how to learn lessons from America about how to make public life function in this new era, look to America to understand the ways that religious life in America ameliorated what could never really be cured, which was this kind of heightened spiritual rawness and temptation to wear oneself out in the scramble to remain in the mix in democratic times. So that
Everything's
was,
horizontally oriented
yes.
so that we compete. We're all equals competing with each other.
And we're competing to conform to
This is
increasingly
where, I guess,
global standards.
Gerard entered
Right.
stage left versus a
Yes.
vertical orientation that where we're attempting to conform within the church to Christ and the saints rather than to each other.
Right. And so Tocqueville wanted to draw attention to the way that that religion was seemingly paradoxically becoming more important, not less so, in increasingly democratic ages. We could spend many hours talking about all of that, but that's kind of where I thought there were some relatively accessible lessons, nuggets of wisdom that relatively ordinary people who might find themselves in a Barnes and Noble or whatever, could pull off the shelf and have a browse through and come away feeling a little bit less lost and despairing and confused.
Do you think it's still that what he says about religion is still the case?
Well, he talks about the Americans and he says, look, a people, a nation is like a single man. And if you want to understand who a person is, you ought to go back to their origins to understand exactly who they are and why. And the same thing applies to the body of people. And so he goes back to America's origins, which for him is the Puritans, the Anglo-Americans. Who arrived on the shores of New England. Yeah, there were the Virginians and stuff, but these people were just kind of like looking for a good time or some financial opportunities or make a buck or get away from the law or whatever. He didn't have a very high estimate of the early settlers who were not Puritans. And what amazed him about the Puritans was that the strictness of their religious observance and the free rein that they cherished in political life were very complimentary for them. And in this, he saw the hope of religious life providing the kind of ballast and structure and consolation and shelter for people in a democratic age without having to subject them to a tyrannical political regime. And his hope was that America could be used as a kind of guidebook to surviving the democratic age by reconciling political freedom and religious authority. Fast forward to 2024, checking in on the legacy of Puritanism, I think there are a lot of problems. I think it's just simply a matter of the historical record that Puritanism was unable to replicate itself, unable to preserve its religious strictures. It was just a few generations before you got Unitarianism and Universalism and Oneida and Transcendentalism and Ralph Waldo Emerson and the fracture of the mainline Protestant churches in America and all manner of revivals and evangelicalism and Mormonism. And American spirituality has really not looked back since and continues to fracture into rival cults and factions that have serious retention issues. I'm not here to bag on anyone's faith, but I think it's certainly challenging to Tocqueville's thesis, what has become of the heirs of Puritanism in America. And it raises some serious questions about where American Christians ought to turn in order to find some stable ground, in order to build their house on rock and not sand, so to speak. So these are deep and pressing issues, and I think they've really come to the fore in an inescapable way because of what technology is doing to us and what it is laying bare and forcing us to remember and forcing us to confront.
So you write about the shift from what you call the televisual age to the digital age. The televisual age defined by imagination, and the digital age defined by memory. Do I have that right?
Yes.
Okay. So what does that mean? The televisual age defined by imagination, digital age defined by memory.
Well, so this is all coming out of Marshall McLuhan, who, I certainly think that he was very insightful on these issues, and he was also not a political theorist, but rather a media theorist. And so he wanted to understand technologies of communication, what he called extensions of man, and he wanted to understand how they exerted effects on their creators and users without regard to the feelings or the intentions or even the awareness of the creators and users of these media. McLuhan, a Catholic convert who said that he came in on his knees, very devout guy, perhaps not surprising then that he put a lot of stock in Aristotle. And so Aristotle had his four causes. McLuhan was a great exponent of formal cause, which Straussians don't like very much, at least the East Coast Straussians, so some of whom actually accuse Aristotle of lying about formal cause, and willfully too. Anyway, story for another day. McLuhan liked formal cause. He thought it was very important to understanding media, exactly for this reason, that it wasn't, it's not like a blueprint that someone draws up. That's not an example of formal cause. Formal cause causes forms. And so he wanted to look at the way that communications technologies developed and how the development of those technologies was not linear and incremental and cumulative, which is oftentimes what you hear out of people from tech world who are like, no, it's just all one thing, it's all tech, and if the tech isn't working, that we just need more tech, and there's nothing that's wrong with tech that can't be fixed by what's right with tech, and it's just basically like piling up innovation on innovation until you reach the stars or whatever. McLuhan says no. He worked on a tetrad of media effects with his son Eric McLuhan later in his life, and these media effects kind of reflect or echo Aristotle's four causes. And the aim there was to show that it's these different media can have radically different effects. And these effects can all sort of be happening simultaneously. So an example would be you look at the printing press. That was McLuhan's book, The Gutenberg Galaxy. You look at the printing press. What does it enhance? What does it obsolesce? What does it reverse or sort of turn back on itself? You look at radio, you look at television, you look at the computer, and you go through all these things, and he applies this framework and generates some unexpected results. So, everyone kind of intuitively understands that that these extensions of man enhance certain of our faculties or characteristics. And we kind of intuitively understand that technological innovation can make things obsolete. But the fourth media effect that I did not mention until now is retrieval. So McLuhan took pains to point out that like actually things that you thought were behind us, things that you thought belonged to a bygone age that would never return, well, depending on the kind of communications media that you invent and use, these things can come roaring back. And if you're not prepared for that, you're going to be blindsided and very confused. So you look at television, and probably not very controversial to say television enhances imagination. Human imagination. If you can dream it, you can do it. Pure imagination. Imagine all the people. Every kind of major catchphrase from that kind of high modernist age in America pretty much had to do with this article of faith that dreaming was the source of real power, that whoever dreamed the biggest and best dreams would rule the world through that power and would deserve to rule the world through that power. And that was peak America. That's the
Walt
energy
Disney.
that America ran on as it more or less took over the world and fought for domination of the world with the communists and succeeded eventually. And that left a lot of people, whether at the very top of American society or at the bottom, with this euphoric feeling of omnipotence and superpower. And it was this culture that brought the internet into being, brought the computer into being, the personal computer, commercialized these things. And these things were so readily commercialized because they began as military technologies. You look at Star Wars, you look at Darth Vader's helmet, everything from there up until right up to your touchscreen cell phone, GPS, all of these things. And again, this is just a matter of the historical record. All of them were spin-offs of military technology, repurposed for really for entertainment, for commercial entertainment. And the belief that animated this incredible transformation of our everyday life was, we dreamed the biggest and best dreams, so anything that we build, anything that we create, is going to be good for us. It's going to be our friend. It's going to just continue to enhance our power and our authority, and we're going to Americanize the world with this stuff, and we're all going to live happily ever after.
Can
And
I
obviously,
jump in briefly?
yeah.
Bee in My Bonnet lately is last year I read Richard Rhodes' Making of the Atomic Bomb, which is a great book. And one of the things he, I think, unintentionally demonstrates is that the real motivation for the developers of the atomic bomb, I mean, Leo, Sl I don't know how to pronounce his name, Szilard, Szil, anyway, I can't pronounce all these Hungarian names. And Oppenheimer and a lot of the other guys were very explicit about it. It was H.G. Wells and the dream of world peace through world government, that the atomic bomb would end wars forever, and usher in world peace through world government. We would all be one people, happy forever. And that this was the motivation. Not just the atomic bomb, but also for aerial bombardment, that was also going to achieve something of the same end, just less efficiently than atomic weapons. And so that this dream of world peace through world government, unity of all peoples, that no amount of death and destruction was too high as long as it was aiming towards this end. And the Rhodes never puts together at the end of his book, he has all these dreams about like the UN and so on regulating some sort of world force regulating nuclear weapons, and he never realizes that his same motivation there is the one that motivated the weapons in the first place.
Yeah,
But it
it's an
seems like it's
incredible
a
one. So.
similar dream for the internet, right?
Yes.
That this has been a long held dream of I don't know what to call it, the American ruling class. I don't know what word to use exactly, but this dream of world peace and world unity, as you noted, I mean, it just comes up again and again in pop culture songs and so on. I don't know if anyone writes about it politically in the way they did in the early 20th century. And when people were very open, it was not like a controversial or strange idea. People would just, write about it pretty openly. But it seemed like that the internet had a similar motivation, which you can, if you read old issues of Wired magazine and the sort of really high point of technical optimism, certainly that came through during the so-called Arab Spring. I remember when there was a lot, the Peter Thiel debate with Eric Schmidt, which I think is should be considered a sort of major event in some ways. And I recommend everyone go back and watch that and see who was more right. But am I wrong in thinking this is still a main motivating passion or
Well, no, you are not. And so to pick back up where I left off, it's exactly this. The people who created the internet and the personal computer and commercialized military technology into mass entertainment really did not understand what they were doing, in McLuhan's sense of they thought it was just more tech. We're just continuing forward with more innovation, and we are kind of, we have the biggest and best dreams, and so it's all going to work out well. And so they did not anticipate that this was a new medium that they were creating, not just an extension of what had come before. And that this new medium was going to have effects on our environment and on our inner and outer lives that were simply fundamentally different from the kinds of effects that televisual technology had. And so suddenly we go from a world where human imagination rules to a world where machine memory rules. The retrieval of memory as the dominant faculty, which had not been the dominant faculty in our cultural and spiritual and commercial lives since probably the Middle Ages. That is a tremendously wrenching transformation, and it is one that in some ways is new, but in other ways is only new, really new, insofar as it is the surprising return of something that almost everyone had come to assume would never, we'll never go back to the Dark Ages. And if we do go back, it'll only be because like the bad guys blow everything up. And so, that's what you can take away from McLuhan and plenty of Catholic intellectuals and analysts who have been tracking this stuff. The French, the French managed to see a lot of this stuff before the Americans did, whether you're looking at Tocqueville or later, Girard or Elul or Virilio or Baudrillard. I mean, it's kind of a silly how long the list is. However, if you want to zoom out a little bit, I think that you don't have to go through those kinds of intellectual stages of understanding in order to recognize that at the most general scale, these changes in media do not change the fundamental spiritual situation of human beings, and the longing to unify everything and to usher in a kind of a new Eden on Earth, or even off Earth, or some combination thereof. This is a deep and abiding desire to recreate paradise in a place that is hidden from God. That is what is at the root of what we are seeing unfold today. And you don't need a PhD in political theory, and you don't need to read the corpus of Marshall McLuhan, and you don't need to write a book about Alexis de Tocqueville in order to understand that. And so it now seems suddenly that we're rather late in the game, and people are really starting to freak out about humans being replaced and the end of the world and the Antichrist and on and on. And in one sense, that's understandable, but in another sense, this is always the condition that we find ourselves in, and we shouldn't allow the quote unquote mind-blowing experience of digital technology blind us to the fact, make us forget that this is the human predicament that we have always found ourselves in since the fall, is this condition of trying to hide from God and to create a substitute paradise. That's really what's at stake here, and that's what I'm mostly interested in within my own sort of area of exploration, is to just try to get that across in as plain spoken terms as I can.
I read something this week that Joseph Ratzinger, Pope Benedict XVI, wrote in the 1970s. It says, where human fatherhood disappears, it is no longer possible to speak and think of God. It is not God who is dead. What is dead, at least to a large extent, is the precondition in man that makes it possible for God to live in the world. The crisis of fatherhood that we are experiencing today is a basic aspect of the crisis that threatens mankind as a whole. Okay, that was, he wrote that in the 1970s, half a century ago, I think, prescient, prophetic. Something also comes to mind from George Bernanos, another 20th century Catholic. I don't know. I'm not Catholic, but here I am. I don't know. It's a rich tradition, intellectual tradition. So George Bernanos calls modern civilization a conspiracy against all internal life. So I think that what Ratzinger says is true, and I think that precondition in man he talks about, I think that the disappearance or the threat to internal life is equal in danger to the disappearance of fatherhood. And so from my perspective, the cataclysm is already here, that the introduction of ChatGPT and these sort of things doesn't, the digital life has already eroded. Like we're a nerd to it, so it's hard to tell, but I think it's eroded our ability to attend to things and sort of destroyed internal life in such a degree that it's hard to even imagine. It's hard to look at it. You can't, hard to look at it from the outside.
Yeah, that's quite right. I open Human Forever with basically the claim that that this big scary apocalyptic thing that you're worried about, like it has already taken place. And so you can stop worrying about that now. And let's move on to understanding what it is that now we must do. I mean the Catholic intellectual tradition on this stuff is definitely quite rich, and at this late date, it's kind of a double-edged sword. I mean, what was once almost the secret knowledge of the intellectuals of the most penetrating minds is now just kind of like the painfully obvious reality of mo life moment to moment, that even the sort of troll looking guy on the bottom end of the bell curve meme, understands perfectly well. It's we're swimming around in a certain kind of soup, and it's many people are now experiencing the reckoning that arises from being able to see the soup that you're swimming around in.
So I
It's
want to
not.
turn now to what we ought to do.
Sure, yeah.
So I have questions about your Bitcoin hypothesis, but to me, there's some very basic steps that anyone can do that just seem necessary for, I don't know, retaining something in the face of all of this. Smartphones to me seem irredeemable and a mistake, and we just need to certainly not give them to our children, but abandon them ourselves. It's pretty easy not to have one, have a flip telephone, whatever. You mentioned being on Twitter X. I found that that was sort of uniquely destructive, at least for me, of my like capacity to have an intellectual or spiritual life. Had to like abandon it. And I assume the same with the video one, TikTok and these sorts of things, which I think were actually almost designed to destroy like capacity for internal life and for intellectual life, spiritual life. And then we had to create situations where we're encountering reality. So, I mean, the straightforward ways to do this are in family life, like you having children, church life with the sacraments, and then even just like lifting heavy things, growing food even in a small way, fighting. These things where you're just there's no you can abstract them, you can layer abstractions on top of them, but at the end of the day, there's sort of unavoidable encounter re with reality inherent to them. So that to me is, at least in a small way, what any person can do to begin, just to maintain some semblance of virtuous or good life. And I can't see how Bitcoin and so on could possibly be involved in any of that. But maybe I'm missing something, because I haven't been able to figure out, even on a basic level, what Bitcoin is. It seems to me like it's a major vehicle for money laundering, I assume. But beyond that, I don't understand what it is or how it can help us. So could you lay out your vision or plan of that, and maybe you can correct me if my, or I guess Luddite thing isn't a good program.
Yeah, well, I'm certainly not going to tell someone that they should turn away from God's calling to give up everything in their life to follow him. Like, you don't need a smartphone, you don't need electricity, you don't need a plumbing, you don't need any of that stuff. And really sort self-stripping down to the absolute basics is a recognized approach to seeking holiness on this earth. And I'm an Orthodox Christian. I think that we are over-intellectualized. I think that there are many very well-meaning people today who were raised in a culture that made an idol of the intellect, that gambled everything economically and socially on intellectualism. And I think that intellectualism as we know it is actually profoundly at odds with the reality that our technological condition is throwing us back on. You can go back to the Desert Fathers and their spiritual heirs to hear time and time again that vain philosophy and smarts and abstract arguments are not going to save us. They are not a source of spiritual salvation. And the fact that technology is now so capable of simulating and automating intellectual content and intellectual products, I think. It's a frightening thing to behold in some senses, but in another sense, apparently this is what we need to be slapped across the face with in order to go, oh, right. Intellectualism is not the answer. It's not going to save us. It's not going to allow us to escape our responsibility to God, and it's not going to allow us to transform substitutes for God into, or sorry, supplements in our life into substitutes for the spiritual life.
Isn't it the case too that, like, for example, all of the large language models, that the writing they spit out or the images they spit out are impressive only to the extent that the people impressed by them have no aesthetic or intellectual formation? Like, anyone who's actually reads good writing or experience beautiful art, the stuff looks really dumb.
Well, I mean, there's of course there's something to that, but I would even beyond that say that you don't need to be literate to look at the output of these machines and recognize that they are soulless. And that it's okay to have a computer do a calculation. Like that's not there's nothing evil about that. And so on the one hand, I do want to discourage over-intellectualization. And on the other hand, I want to discourage Americans, Christians from going overboard in kind of the other direction of like, oh, I would never let my child, have a calculator, or I would never let my child, learn how to read. I mean, these things are
Is that
tools.
really on the table?
Well, not right now, but I think it's easy to see how out of a kind of desperation and frustration and giving into temptation to a certain kind of arrogance or pride, a lot of people could say, you know what, we're just going to destroy all this stuff, and we're going to ban it, and we're going to use the law to save us. The law isn't going to save us. What is going to save us is to begin right here in our hearts, and to exercise spiritual discipline, spiritual asceticism, and not be led around by the nose by our passions, by our dreams, by our senses, by our feelings. These things are the real portals to delusion and despair and perversion and sinfulness, laziness, gluttony, all the bad stuff. The heart is is infinitely deeper and more mysterious and more of a dangerous portal than our smartphones are. And to say, well, I have thrown away my phone, so I'm now saved. Like, well, would that it were so simple, but it's not that simple. And the
Well,
place
I
to begin,
don't, I mean,
as
who?
tempting as it is to throw away our technology, the place to begin is in our hearts. And if we succeed in making devoting our lives to spiritual practices that strengthen and root us in a proper relationship with God, then we are going to have the requisite spiritual strength and authority to pick up technological tools and use them to defend ourselves from those who are trying to wipe us out. And that's important.
It seems to me that a lot of these technologies make the kind of spiritual practice you describe, developing those spiritual habits, incredibly, they work against it. So I agree with you that tossing your phone away is not in itself, doesn't save you. It puts you what in the condition of someone in 1996.
Which a lot of people, a lot of people are still holding, please, please, like, let it be possible for me to just, like, somehow get, if I can just get back to 96, then just be a
Sure.
normal
And we're getting
96
lots of
person.
nineteen nineties reruns. I think it's fun that like political correctness on campus, you know, this is a '90s rerun. We've already done this, seen this before. And now it's just we're doing it again, but a little dumber than last time. Like everyone involved is a little dumber than last time. Or like the sort of identity obsession of the new left from the 70s. We're getting that again, but just dumber and like more bureaucratic. But I guess I just don't understand how you, let's say someone has, I guess, trained themselves, you know, in the habits, spiritual habits of ascesis. I'm not sure what that means exactly in terms of using the internet and so on, but I guess I still don't understand how, for example, Twitter can be used to destroy someone who doesn't use it, or Bitcoin, which I don't understand at all, can be used to destroy people who just don't participate in them.
Well, look, I, I've been working with these issues and with people in this space on the media side, the political side, the technological side for a number of years now. And the conclusion that I've come to is that if we do not compute under God, if we do not compute in Christ, then we are going to be computed. It's very clear what the other guys want to do. They want to create one master feed, and they want to control that feed, and they want to determine your place in society by your ranking in that feed. That's what Sam Bankman-Fried wanted to do with FTX. That's what Elon Musk wants to do with X, an app for everything, one ring to rule them all. You look at what the Biden administration is doing. They want a social justice, social credit system. You can't have fully realized wokeness, unless you have a woke supercomputer, because it's all about perfecting purely human justice. It is about that desire to be throwing the thunderbolts, like the atom bomb, just spread out into the most intimate areas of human life, to unite everyone around a universal algorithm. And to conform them to the dictates of whatever priestly caste is set up to provide commands to the computers. That's what they want, and that's what
So
they're
if you
going to get
don't have a
on the left.
smartphone, for example, and you're not part of said universal feed, I can understand the why some would have a desire for that. It seems, given the capacity that exists now in American bureaucracies, I'm a little skeptical of their ability to pull it off. Maybe American bureaucrats in 1960, but I'm not sure about American bureaucrats in 2024 to maintain such a thing. But it wouldn't the fight then not be to try to wrest control of these things or reform them or shape them in a particular way? But for example, it would be to preserve the ability to pay for things with cash, to have relationships with your neighbors and local farmers, like all the old localist fights. Wouldn't those become sort of the center of how we put a wall between ourselves and that sort of dream, rather than attempting to compete or control it on the digital side?
Well, look, of course, if you live in a functioning neighborhood with people who have not lost their minds, you should definitely partake of life with them. No question. But hoping that localism is going to insulate you from the unbridled energies of public and private industry to overlay all of life with a kind of virtual vivarium, it's not going to be enough. What is needed is a spiritual authority institutionalized throughout society that is strong enough and organized enough to answer the burning question that people have in this technologized world, which is, what are we supposed to do with these things? How are we supposed to handle these things? They're not going to go away. If they fall into the wrong hands, they're going to be used to imprison us and destroy our spiritual life. And so what action can we take? Well,
Practically,
you can
what does that
retreat.
look like?
You can run away, right? And so you can retreat and you can hide and you can hope for the best. Or you can lay your hands on defensive weaponry that is available to you and protect those you love and all that is worth cherishing and protecting by using these tools for those defensive purposes.
Could you be more
So when you look,
specific as
when you
someone
look,
out there who wants to, as you put it, lay hold on the defensive weaponry? What does that look like?
well, look at Bitcoin. What can Bitcoin be used to do? Well, you can use it to buy and sell like cartoon monkeys. You can use it to hope that the value of it will just continue to go up, and you can, move to some Central American beach or a mountain in the Himalayas and meditate and think about nothing and just watch the number go up, and then you're rich and you don't have to worry about anything again in your life. Or instead of going down those fruitless rabbit holes, you can use it to provide people who have spiritual integrity with a digital citadel. Where they can create markets and they can exchange goods and services free from the control of people who want to destroy their humanity, destroy their spirituality, destroy their political freedom. This is a tool that is sitting, that is ready to be used right now. And if good people do not take the opportunity to put that tool to work for us, it is going to be taken away. It is going to be dominated and mastered by people who do not have our best interests at heart and who do not worship the God we worship. And it is going to be used against us. And you know, that might not be an ideal situation, but we need to be honest about the situation that we find ourselves in. Look, there are going to be a lot of people, millions and millions of people, who look around at the world that they're in and say, "This sucks. I don't want to participate." And what are their options going to be? Well, on the other side, you've got the suicide pod. You've got climb into the VR helmet. You've got infinite supply of automated pornography. Okay, well, what are we offering on our side? And what we can offer is the monastic life. And what we can offer is using basic digital technologies to provide our people with a foundation for the basic cultural and commercial functions of life, free from surveillance, control, censorship, behavior modification, social credit, free from all that stuff. I think that that's powerful. I think we don't have many options to choose from, and I think that the hour is late.
How does it work better than cash?
Well, I don't know how many like trendy cafes you frequent over the course of your days, but out here in California, it is becoming increasingly common for businesses to simply say, "Yeah, we don't take cash. We're cashless. It's better for the environment. We don't want to do it." And it's like, "Well, this is legal tender," and they just don't care. You go look at the federal government, what are they trying to do? They want to get rid of cash. Oh, cash is for criminals. Cash, yeah, that's North Korean counterfeiting. Cash is dirty, you know. Oh, COVID, we need to not have cash, physical money exchange in people's hands. Remember the coin shortage that we had a couple of years ago? Like the government wants cash to go away. They want to replace it with central bank digital currencies. Are we going to just stand here and say, "Well, we'd be better off if we had cash"? Well, guess what? They don't care. They're taking dramatic action right now to consolidate all of this technological power. To stop the internet from being a place where you can be an American in the way that we've been more or less from the beginning. So yeah, it's going to be, you know, the options are being taken off of the table aggressively by people who do not want our way of life to continue. And we can either stand there and watch it happen, or we can do something about it.
All right. Maybe I'm not smart enough to understand. I have to
Well, I
admit,
don't think, you know, I don't think
I
it's
just
a
don't.
It's not an intellectual matter though. You know, you can begin using Bitcoin like right now with maybe 15 minutes of prep work to, you know, to buy my book and lots of other guys' book on a website. It's really not rocket science. I know that people, you know, they hear all this chatter about Bitcoin and it's like, "Oh, I don't know. It seems like crazy people are just talking about nonsense." Well, that's pretty much true about everything on the internet. So don't let that like cloud your judgment. You don't have to be, you don't have to be a techie. You don't have to be, you know, a media professional. You don't have to be anything. You can use it to buy and sell books or icons or candles or many things. There really isn't some, you know, you don't need to read a textbook. You just need to start using it. Experience in this, as in all things, is a better teacher than a textbook.
Okay, well, my brief attempts to dabble in it, I couldn't make heads or tails of it, and I'm still I don't so the worry is that that you won't be able to buy the books you want with cash or a debit card or something like that, or that if you buy the wrong books, you'll be put on some kind of registry and then denied employment, something in the manner of what China is attempting to do.
Yeah, I mean, this is where we are right now. You know, you go there are one or two book chains. You go in there, it's a very limited selection. You go on to Amazon. There are problems there, and even if, you know, there are some good books that you can still get on Amazon. I've gotten some good books on Amazon because they show up to my door the next day, and oftentimes I have to write stuff and I need the resource, and that, well, they deliver the goods, and that's fine. But what's not fine is Amazon's book business is not what made them into Amazon. It's Amazon Web Services. They're running the servers for the CIA, for GCHQ, for for the Borg, for the bad guys. And so what's our alternative going to be? Just kind of living underground and secretly exchanging beaten up books from 1885. I mean, it's one way to do it, but it's not the only way to do it.
I mean, it seems like a false dichotomy to me. There's a lot of people printing and selling books, and that aren't either of those, either.
Yeah, there are monasteries that have presses. That's good. I'm certainly not telling people not to publish books if they're able to do so. But again, the book is just one example. There for all the good stuff that's out there in books, it's not like amassing the perfect library is going to get us out of this mess. We got
Okay.
to expand this into other areas of cultural and commercial life. I mean, look, if the money, if the if our own money supply is turned into a tool of our spiritual oppression, because yeah, you can have different kinds of regimes and different kinds of laws, and sometimes the laws aren't what you want them to be, but this regime is not content to simply overdo it with laws. This regime wants to invade the spiritual realm of the church and violate that realm and impose itself and impose its new religion on people like you and me. And there needs to be an organized response, and that response needs to be consistent with the wisdom of the church and the wisdom of the ages on what kind of person you need to be in your spiritual life in order to have the proper discernment, so that you can bear to take up weapons and use them against those who are trying to wipe you out.
Well, I think I'm going to stick with handwriting letters and planting a garden. But
Nothing wrong with letters and gardens.
yeah.
Hard to.
Okay. Well, let's wrap up on the spiritual on a spiritual note. I began by introducing you as the newly illumined. So you're newly joined the Orthodox Church, and I'm curious about that, both your journey there, and what, if anything, changed. Like, in the were you baptized or chrismated? Had you been previously
Baptized.
baptized? Okay, amazing. So, I'm an Orthodox Christian too, so I'm curious, yeah, about that. If you don't mind sharing about, how you arrived at Orthodoxy, and how that, I mean, I think it's come out a lot in everything you've said over the course of this conversation, but how you see your work being shaped or shifted by, your new entrance into the life of the mysteries of the church.
Sure. Yeah. Well, a couple angles in on this. One of them is, I was, like so many Americans, raised up in a world, in a culture where intelligence was the measure of worth. It determined everything. It determined who you could marry. It determined what kind of job you could get. It could determine how many social classes you could sort of rise up in. It determined your power. It determined your prestige. It determined who were your friends, and it determined everything. College, higher education became an idol in the 80s and the 90s. And the spectacle of so many well-meaning boomer parents, with absolutely the best of intentions, many of them who came from working class backgrounds, many of whom Either they were the first in their family to go to college, or even they hadn't yet been to college. And it was just dangling out there, dazzling people. Oh, if I can just get my kid into college, the best college they can get into, that's what's going to set them up. If I can just get them over the wall, then they're going to, the whole the new Eden of late 20th century America, the gates are going to swing right open and they're going to go, walk into the sun, and it's going to be that, or it's going to be working some, BS job in their hometown, slinging hamburgers, working in the factory. A nightmare for many boomers who left collapsing industrial, post-industrial towns, especially in the Midwest or the Northeast. Many of them moving west, many of them coming to California, looking for a better life, and it all made sense on paper. And then these kids get into college, and what do? They discover that actually, rich people are oftentimes totally messed up in the head, and psychologically, sexually, addiction, trauma, greed, jealousy, not spiritually well individuals. And I think that was a deeply traumatizing experience for a lot of people who got boosted up by well-meaning parents. They got into college and discovered that it was basically like, a spiritually very dark place, and they had to somehow figure out how to prevail in that environment. And then let's say you do, and you get your degree, and then you get out, and then what are you going to do with that degree? Like, well, maybe not what you anticipated. And so maybe you go back to school again for an advanced degree, and you repeat the process all over again, and then you get out, and then like it's you still can't really make it pencil out. And I think a lot of Americans have been cycled through this and have the spiritual scars to prove it. And there's been this terrible disenchantment of the intellect and intellectualism and the idolatry of intellect has led us to a very dark place. And at the same time that so many people have been overeducated and overexperienced in the ways of the world and have really nothing to show for it, weren't able to create stable families, weren't able to create stable professional life, weren't able to pay off their debts, just kind of in this weird limbo, then what's going on in the upper echelons is, well, these super, super smart people are creating super, super smart machines, and they're going to use intellect to rule over all of these failed intellectuals. It's terrible. It is the ruin of this country. And how do you respond spiritually to that? I found it to be, not persuasive that a kind of Christianity that was really just like wagering on its ability to be the most right about everything intellectually, to really master reason, that seemed to me to not be the right path to go down. What seemed to me the right path to go down was a return to the Christianity of purifying the heart and of throwing yourself at the mercy of a God who is not just the smartest being in the universe, or the Lord of all creation, or even just the Father of all, but a loving God, a God who loves you with a depth and an intimacy that is beyond comprehension and beyond what any human being or human beings can provide. I mean, what a disgusting lie it is to say that love is love, as if love is the ultimate measure of all things. Well, love is love means that all loves are equal, and so equality is actually the measure of all things. And what the equality of all loves implies is that there isn't a distinction between the love of God and the love of merely mortal love, when of course there absolutely is, and that's the centerpiece of the whole thing. And so all of these, there's just kind of the incredibly crushing spiritual burden of recognizing that so much of American life was led down the primrose path of intellectualism. And that led people to living hell in many respects. Christianity ought to provide an even more overpowering antidote, an even more overpowering refuge, an escape from the prison of over-intellectualization. And to me, the Orthodox Church is that. And it's not to say that the intellect is not welcome, of course. It's simply that to unite the will and the intellect and the heart. My patron saint, Gregory Palamas, here's a guy who's very well educated, very articulate, very capable of slinging, very powerful arguments and writing lots of intellectual things and so forth. But what did he use those tools to do? And what he used them to do was to defend the primacy of mystical experience and of the heart over the mind and of the practice of monastic prayer over the attempts to explain it at all. I think that is extremely powerful and extremely necessary, and I think a lot of people are crying out for that today. So that's one way of answering your question. There's some other ways too, but maybe I'll save them for another time.
Perfect. Well, that's a great place to stop. Thank you, James, so much for coming on and talking to me about all this. I think it was, anyway, I love talking to people with whom I share so many perspectives as to what is going wrong, but who have completely different ideas about what we ought to do in the face of that. So thank you.
Well, it all starts with the heart. So, when in doubt, go there.